So it's a pleasure to welcome you, and we're going to have some great speakers who'll describe the need to knock down the barriers that keep patients with primary immune deficiency from getting the care they need. First, it's a pleasure to introduce Patrick Collins, the Director of Public Affairs North America at CSL Behring, who are the wonderful sponsors of our breakfast symposium. So please join me in welcoming Patrick. Thank you.
Well, good morning, and from the looks of people this morning, I see that many of you were at Bourbon Street last night or elsewhere in New Orleans partying the night away. So good morning, have lots of coffee, get some of that caffeine, and we're going to dive right into the session this morning on knocking down barriers to care. I have to tell you, at CSL, we are very proud to have a long partnership, a long collaboration with the Immune Deficiency Foundation on building the bridges and finding ways to circumnavigate the insurance world, ensuring that there is access to individuals to be able to obtain the immune globulin that is best for them. So navigating the world of step therapy, preferred formularies, other types of barriers to insurance, both in the public and private sectors. So again, I just want to say thank you this morning. I think we have a very distinguished panel that you'll hear from. And again, it's our pleasure to be a sponsor of this event this morning. And wish you all a very joyous remainder of the conference and safe travels home. So thank you all very much.
Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone's enjoying their breakfast. We have a very interesting program. We hope that you will look at and honor all the issues that we are going to bring talking about this morning. It's my pleasure also to welcome you to the breakfast symposium of Knocking Down the Barriers to Care. This morning we'll have several speakers who will describe the need to knock down those barriers and keep patients with PI from getting the care they need, when they need it, where they need it, with what they need. This morning's program will discuss some of those obstacles to care that you all face almost every day. We will hear about what our patient community is experiencing in the insurance marketplace, the changes that the Affordable Care Act has brought to that marketplace, new health policies that are being discussed right now on Capitol Hill, and other issues affecting the PI community. All these issues demand that voices of the PI community, you, be raised to advocate for change, for changes that tear down the barriers to care for all patients, including patients with PI. We're especially fortunate today to have a panel of speakers. Mr. Christopher Scalchunes is Senior Director of Survey Research for the Immune Deficiency Foundation. Ms. Sue Rantham is Principal and Senior Vice President of Heart Health Strategies. Mr. Mark Booten is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Health Council. And I will follow up with a look on how IDF is addressing these issues and more. If time allows, there will be a question and answer period at the end of the presentation. All questions should be submitted in writing. You should have been handed an index card, or there may be index cards on your table. If you have a question, please write it down. An IDF staff member or volunteer will be around to pick them up during the program. Presenters will answer as many questions as possible. And thank you for understanding that there is a limited amount of time and all questions may not be answered. However, we are going to try to answer those unanswered questions today in the question and answer section of the IDF e-newsletter that will be appearing in a few weeks. One of the things that is important when trying to educate policymakers is to have facts. Personal stories are very important, but having facts and data coupled with those personal stories are quite effective and very persuasive. To that end, IDF has, for over 20 years, produced some of the most extensive data about the PI community anywhere. With the recent changes in the overall health insurance system, IDF decided to survey the experiences of PI patients with the health insurance system. To tell you about what your responses to that IDF health insurance survey of 2014, I present IDF Senior Director of Research, Christopher Schoutchunes. In his almost 9 years here at IDF, Christopher has conducted numerous surveys, including the IDF National Patient National Treatment Surveys. He has also co-authored a number of journal articles that are based on IDF survey results. Recently, he has been acting as the project manager for both the IDF EPHR platform as well as IDF's PI Connect patient-powered research network. Christopher is here today to help us understand results from IDF's latest survey about the impact of health insurance on our patient population. Christopher?
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, everyone. So, isn't it great to spend a Saturday morning looking at tons of charts, graphs, and frequency distributions? I can't find a better way to spend my Saturday morning, so thank you for joining me. So, as Larry mentioned, IDF's got a long history of tracking data for a patient community. It's one of the ways we have a voice for our payers, our policymakers, and researchers. So, recent history demonstrates to us that our patients are very sensitive to changes in how healthcare is delivered, how healthcare is paid for, and how healthcare and site of care and changes that can disrupt our population. And we know this not based just on surveys. We've all been through that and we know that. But IDX has been able to demonstrate these issues. For example, when changes to the Medicare Modernization Act occurred in the early 2000s, there were some unintended consequences of that. One of those, of course, was the fact, as many of you may know, was Medicare recipients and beneficiaries couldn't receive IVIG effectively in the home. So these are some of the types of things that we like to get ahead of. With the Affordable Care Act coming into being just a few years ago and now solidified by the Supreme Court, we knew that there were going to be certain good things for our community, excellent things that come out of this. However, we also know that sometimes when the rubber hits the road, and when it gets time for these policies to be enacted, sometimes they're interpreted differently, and that can cause issues for us. So we want to stay ahead of this as much as we can and be proactive instead of reactive. So this past year, IDF as a team decided to survey our patients, and we did the survey in 2014, and we'll continue to do it in 15 and 16 to track how changes in healthcare reform may impact our patient community. The survey specifically looked at things such as out-of-pocket costs, cost-sharing, premium costs, annual limits, essential benefits, and access to preferred therapies, as well as access to specialists. So this was a web-based survey. We had up to 60 questions, depending on responses, and we had it in the field for just about 3 weeks in November and December of this past year. Over 1,500 of you out there completed the survey, so thank you very much for your participation. It's desperately needed as we fight together. We are in the process of developing a manuscript on this survey, and we're aiming to have that published in a peer-reviewed journal that's aimed at health insurance companies and managed care organizations. So this is our first slide. As you can see here, this is the breakdown, or if you're in the back, you might not be able to see, but this is the breakdown of insurance by type for those who completed the survey. Approximately 70% of those who responded are receiving their care through private payers in one form or another. The other thing to note that I find interesting is that roughly 20% of the respondents rely on Medicare in one form or another to help pay for their health care and hence pay for their IG. This has remained relatively constant over all of the surveys I've had experience with IDF. It may move a little bit between the different ways Medicare is involved, but it always seems to hover around the 20% mark. Oh, one thing to keep in mind as we go through all of these surveys, 99% of the respondents to this stated they currently had health insurance. So keep that in the back of your mind as you see some of these numbers come up. One of the simple questions we ask of people, do you know how much your monthly premium costs? Something you think that's pretty important to know. So 8 in 10, or almost 80% of the folks out there said, yes, I know what my premium costs are. Of those who knew, the average was about $413 a month. The median, which is at a 50% mark, was $300. This is actually in line with what we find in other national surveys, such as the Kaiser Family Foundation. What I do find interesting, though, as well, is the fact that there are still quite a few people who aren't sure what their health care premiums are. We asked a similar question with the yearly deductibles for our patients, and about 6 in 10, or 62%, as you see on the slide, actually know what the yearly deductible is. Of those who know what their premium is, again, this falls in, or their deductible, I'm sorry, falls in line with what we know from other national insurance surveys. 21% of the folks out there said they didn't have a yearly deductible of some kind, which I suppose could be tied to things like HMOs and those sort of things. We actually haven't been able to dive into the data as deep yet to ascertain that, but we will. Again, very similar, whether or not they knew their maximum out-of-pocket expenses. Again, only about 60% of the people out there really understand what their maximum out-of-pockets are. Good news, again, our community seems to be experiencing their policies and the maximum out-of-pocket cost at about the same average amount per year as we find in the rest of the U.S. population. So this was an interesting question. So we asked people, if the patient were to get seriously ill, how confident would you be that the patient would be able to afford the care that they needed? And that's really what it comes down to. That's why we have health insurance, right? So only 31% were actually very confident that they'd be able to afford this care. That means that there's a certain level of uncertainty for 7 out of 10 of us, 70%, aren't really confident or characterized as being confident that they're going to afford the care. For that matter, approximately 35-36% could be classified as not confident they could afford the care. Again, remember, 99% have health insurance. So these are people who are insured. The good news is, when we asked people if they had access to a specialist in PI, the good news is 85% of the respondents said, yes, I've got access to care. Of those who didn't have access to care, we followed up with a question and asked for the reasons why they didn't. So 36% of those who didn't have access to a specialist said they couldn't find one. But then additionally, the other responses from our folks, as you can see, 10% were not in network, 6% no longer in network. These are health insurance reasons and of obvious concern to us. We have some other simple follow-on questions for other healthcare specialists. So this would be not necessarily immunologists, but we know in our community, unfortunately, many of us have comorbidities, lung impairment, the GI issues, so we see a lot of different specialists. So 14% had a problem seeing a healthcare specialist due to healthcare plan rules. Very specific question. Further, 21% stated that due to the health plan's cost sharing, they had problems affording their visits to see their healthcare specialists. We know that these can have impacts on patient health outcomes. So again, this is of concern, and these are numbers you help supply us with. So the good news on this slide, we asked a question, are you satisfied with the health care that you receive? The good news is 50% stated you're very satisfied with the quality of health care. The bad news is, if I know my numbers right, that means 50% are not satisfied with the quality of their health care. This is an insured population, right? We're a population where we have multiple things going on, and we demand and we deserve the highest level of care possible. So 50% are not satisfied. We asked about some of the other impacts that out-of-pocket costs for health insurance may have on those. And according to our survey respondents, a significant minority made changes to their behavior based on out-of-pocket costs that could have negative consequences on their health, including such things as 23% of the respondents did not fill a prescription due to out-of-pocket costs. 15% skipped medical treatments. Another 15% didn't see a healthcare professional when they had some type of medical problem. 12% skipped the medical test. 10 didn't even bother seeing a specialist. So we know these are not going to optimize your health and the care of those with PI. There are other impacts that go beyond just health that are certainly other quality of life issues. So we asked folks since January of 2014, which of the following have you done in order to pay for the person with PI's healthcare costs? almost half spent less on entertainment. May not say a big deal, but that's a quality of life issue. Almost 4 in 10 spent more on credit cards. 35% less on family. 30% postponed other bills. You can see others, but one that I think is telling, these are people who are, again, insured, 99%. 10% had to apply for government assistance. That has their own policy impacts and outcomes for our healthcare system. For those in the survey who reported that were receiving IG therapy, we asked if at any point in time in the past year, people had skipped or delayed their IG therapy. 1 in 3 had skipped their therapy. We all know that for those of you that receive IG therapy, you need to be receiving your therapy on a consistent basis to prevent those breakthrough infections. But yet 1 in 3, despite being insured, skipped that. Of those who skipped it, we asked the following question. What were the main reason you skipped it? 31% said a problem with health insurance. An additional 9% said the cost was too expensive. So that means 40% of those who skipped their IG did so because they either had a problem with insurance or it was too expensive despite having health insurance. We asked the following question, if people knew if they had copay or coinsurance for their health care. And this is very interesting. So we've seen a shift, obviously, to paying coinsurance, move from copay to coinsurance, which has its own consequences that will be talked about in a little bit. But I found this incredibly interesting. 37% of the people said they had no copay or no coinsurance. That seemed rather high to us. And if there's anyone out there who can help us explain, or other speakers help me explain a little more as to why that may be so, please let me know. We expect that in a certain portion of the population, but that seemed a little bit high. We also asked, as I was talking about, the shift to coinsurance seems to have its own consequences. So we asked, well, what's your monthly cost for IG therapy? So on average, those who have co-pays was $222, with the median being just under $70. However, 17% of the people didn't know what their monthly cost was for therapy. Those with coinsurance stated that their coinsurance costs per month on average were $665, with the median being about $350. However, 34% didn't know what their monthly cost was for their coinsurance for their IG therapy. Thankfully, we asked who helps determine where the patient receives that, and it's nice to report that approximately half of the folks appear to do this in consultation with a healthcare provider. That's good. We always talk about it at IDF, and I'm sure all of you know the decision for therapy should be based on a discussion between the patient and the caregiver, so that's excellent. 30% patients out there said that it was a decision made by the healthcare provider, but of concern to us, as you can see in the green bar there, almost 1 in 5, almost 20% stated that the health insurance company is determining where you receive your therapy. I don't know about you. I haven't gotten a great medical decision out of my health insurance company. I don't expect they always make great decisions. So we asked another simple question. Does your health insurance cover IVIG and SCIG? So 59% of folks said yes, it covers both. But please notice that once again, 38% don't know their own health insurance rules that apply to them or their loved ones. We asked, is it under the medical or pharmacy benefit? And as you'll learn a little bit from some other speakers, there are negative consequences to being moved perhaps to pharmacy benefit. 90% reported that it's under the pharmacy benefit. But again, one-third almost don't understand or don't know how it's being paid for. Other general health insurance rules for those who have co-pays, 44% obviously paid more. I think we've all seen that. We all experienced that. 29% of those with coinsurance stated they're now paying more for the coinsurance than last year. Some to those with co-pays. And this last bullet point, I think, is pretty impactful. And it's a message, I think, out there to everyone. That, again, remember, 99% of the people out there have health insurance. Yet 16% of the respondents had to rely on financial assistance in one form or another, be it co-pay, co-insurance, or health insurance premium costs, in order to help to pay for the health care and their IG therapy. Very simple question we asked to kind of almost sum up here. In January 2014, was there a time when you had a problem paying your medical bills? So you can see 36% had issues despite having health insurance this past year paying for their medical bills. So to sum up, This is a very relatively well-insured group of persons, generally satisfied with the health care that we're receiving. However, there's a substantial minority of persons who have issues with access to care and affording access to care. So despite health insurance, due to out-of-pocket costs, many are forced to make decisions that can impact their health, doing things such as skipping treatments, prescriptions, tests, physician appointments, and 36% had problems paying bills, causing financial strain and hardship on our community. Doing things such as increasing credit card use, postponement to paying other bills, and seeking financial assistance. Of note to me, and I pointed out a few times, a relatively high number of people are not aware of all the intricacies of their health care coverage and costs. So I want to point out to folks that the more information you have means better knowledge for you, means better decisions for everyone out there and your loved ones, and it means better health outcomes for everyone. So I want to thank you for allowing me to take the time here this evening. As I mentioned at the top, we're going to be conducting the survey again in 2015 and 2016 to track how these changes impact our community. We need your participation, so when you get the survey invitation in the mail this fall, please click on it and seriously consider being part of helping us improve care for our patients. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Christopher. You've reported on many pieces of data that can certainly be used in our advocacy efforts. It's always good to be able to, when you say something, to say, this is what's happening with our community and give them numbers to talk about. That has a lot of impact. You've heard a lot this morning about the need for advocacy for patients by patients. It's imperative that people learn to advocate for themselves and others. Only then can change be accomplished. When we work together within our community and with other like-minded patient organizations, we are strong. Each individual has a part to play. I'd like to now give everyone a look at the advocacy activities of IDF since my report in 2013 conference and what we see moving forward. One new aspect is we have some new members of the advocacy team. We have a new director of public policy, Jessica Gilbert, and I don't know where she is at the moment, over there. And we also have Mickey Morgan, who is our government relations specialist. And so we welcome them. They've been here just during this year, the last 6 months, and we appreciate being part of the public policy team. Knocking down the barriers to care. IDF advocates to remove these obstacles by fighting trends such as less choice of physicians, less choice in the sites of care, less choice in the available immunoglobulin therapies. We note, and it was noted in Christopher's report, there's increased cost shifting to patients through coinsurance, higher copays, and higher deductibles. There are restrictive formularies or preferred drug products, which keep people from getting the products that they need. There's inappropriate diagnostic criteria and coverage guidelines that do not follow the standards of care for our patients. These are the kinds of things that you face every day in your life, and we face as an organization and try to do something about that. One of the ways that we've done that was you all participated for years in trying to have the Medicare IVIG Access Act enacted into law, and we were successful in 2012. In 2014, the demonstration program by Medicare started, and it is moving along. There is over 1,000 people who are participating in the program, and we expect to have more, and anyone who is on Medicare and interested in having IVIG in the home, this is a benefit especially for you, and you all can sign up. Go to our website and you'll find out how to do that. Specialty tier coinsurance and cost sharing. The increasing use of cost sharing, as much as we're seeing 50% of the cost of treatment patients are being expected to pay. It's unconscionable. It's economic discrimination. And that needs to be fought. And we are doing that. Newborn screening for SCID. Now there we have some good news. 31 states, over 70% of all births in the country, are being screened for SCID. It's amazing. Marcia talked about it last night, and we have moved greatly. And interesting, I don't know whether how many people have noticed this since they've been here in Louisiana, but on Thursday we had a SCID rally, a rally for SCID newborn screening in Louisiana. Louisiana is one of the states that is not doing screening. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. Biosimilars. We have organized and coordinated a patient coalition of 21 national patient organizations called the Patients for Biologic Safety and Access to look out for the interests of patients as they develop new drugs in the marketplace. And we are also very much involved in the Affordable Care Act implementation, both at the federal level and at the state level. I just talked about the demonstration program that has begun in 2014. And in specialty tier federal activities with regard to coinsurance, there's H.R. 1600, which is our number one legislative concern. And we have been working a couple years with other patient organizations. We have, at this time, 85 bipartisan co-sponsors in the House. We're looking for a sponsor for the Senate. And we will continue to work to support a bill that will, for all intents and purposes, limits the specialty tier cost sharing to those that are on the third tier. In the state, there's been a lot more action with regard to the coinsurance problem. Six states have laws limiting specialty tier coinsurance. And IDF is active in six more states in coalitions trying to enact legislation at the state level to put a restriction and limit on how much people need to pay for out-of-pocket costs. Most people are familiar with premiums, deductibles, and the flat dollar amount of co-payments. But many people really do not understand, especially co-insurance. And you need to look at your plan to see exactly if you're purchasing insurance, if even through your employer, you need to raise the question is making sure of what the costs and out-of-pocket costs are going to be for any particular plan that you choose. The tier used to be, if we saw something that was 20 or 25%, that was unusual. Used to be. Now it's high as 50%. And in some plans, we've seen even 80%. Think about the cost of your infusions and think about what that means. And even though that there is an annual limit set by the Affordable Care Act, what does that mean to you? There's an annual limit for $13,200, I believe, for a family, and half that, $6,600, I think, for an individual. But what does that really mean to you? It means that every January 1st, you got to come up with the entire annual limit at one time. So you're going to have to come up with that $6,600 just so you can have your infusions for the year because of the cost. That's outrageous. And it's just a ploy to keep people from getting their care. It is a way to get around the pre-existing conditions limitation that was performed in the which was enacted in the ACA, and it has to be stopped. So we will continue to work to try to limit those out-of-pocket costs using the studies that we have, that Christopher just articulated, and the data that we have, so that we can try to combat that. So, we also have tremendous and increasing amount of problems with insurance companies. We see trends that happen all the time. You'll recall back in 2009 conference, we were talking about Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Well, then we moved to Highmark Blue Cross. We moved to Coventry, the evil empire. And United Healthcare, Healthcare Services Corp, Anthem Wellpoint. I mean, the list just really does not end. And we continue to work advocating for the right kind of criteria and guidelines, and we've had some pretty decent success. I want to pick out one in particular, which occurred in January 2014, is that the Healthcare Service Corporation, which has the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans in Illinois, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, and Montana. And they decided to come up with this really fun idea of saying, gee, for those folks who have CVID, let's take them off of therapy for 5 or 6 months and see what happens. I'm not kidding when I say that. That was really what they were interested in. It was outrageous. Totally outrageous. So you know what happened? Patients started, our phones started running off the hook. It's like, what is going on in Illinois and Texas? What is this happening? And then we had a couple of volunteers, patients, who said, this is ridiculous. They went on change.org and started a couple of petitions. Within days, they had over 25,000 signatures each, and that continued to climb. Interestingly enough, the media caught on, CNN, Sanjay Gupta's office was calling our patients and saying, what's the deal here? They in turn contacted IDF. And meanwhile, while that was going on, we put together a little mini medical task force to look at this issue and what the heck was going on. We had sent a letter out on a Friday. I got a call back in an hour and a half saying that we need to talk. We got together in about 2 days. We got everybody together for a conference call. They immediately suspended the policy. And we all decided to work collaboratively to find a new policy that will work for patients with primary immune deficiency. That policy went into effect. That policy went into effect last April. There's always a glitch between the policy and implementation. We got those settled out pretty well. But it became probably the best policy in the United States with regard to PI patients. And how did that and why did that happen? Because advocacy by you all getting involved and saying, no, this isn't right. We need to change it. Actually, it works, and we worked side by side with our patients and with the medical community to make sure that this happened. And that's really the moral of the story. Your advocacy. You did it. We continue to work with payers. It's not just always good with, boxing gloves don't always work. We need to educate them. A lot of times, they don't have the expertise that we know among our immunologists. They don't use them. They'll have pediatricians talking about geriatric policies. It doesn't make sense. So we are offering to the payer community, and we try to educate them wherever we can. We've done it through media, with articles and a couple of publications that are industry publications that the payers read. We are going to be sponsoring a symposium at the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy in October. So these are the kinds of efforts that we are doing. Switching to the ACA implementation, we have been providing testimony at every opportunity as to what we have done, what can be done, and what we think should be done at the federal level. And we've also been involved with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. We work with National Health Council, which you'll hear a little bit more about in a few minutes, all together working to try to make sure that this policies are fair, equitable, and do not discriminate. We have a go to our website, please, whenever you have insurance questions. We have the Patient Insurance Center there. We also have a special section on the Affordable Care Act. And please use our website as much as you can. What are biosimilars? Biosimilars are medicines that are highly similar but are not identical. It's not like ibuprofen. It's not like other kinds of medications. Because of the uniqueness and complexity of biologics, biosimilars are not, and nor ever could be, generic copies of biologic medicines. There's a new pathway being produced through the FDA, allowing biosimilars to the market, and 22 patient organizations have gotten together to make sure that when they put together these drugs on the marketplace, that they're done with patient safety in mind. That's really important. Make sure that the voices of patients are being heard and that these new drugs will be safe and effective for our patients. Our principles are very simple. Be safe and effective. Prescribers need to be well informed. Biosimilars should have distinct names so that you know what exactly drug is going into your body. You have a right to know that. And there needs to be a very robust adverse event tracking system so that we know if there's a problem that it can be effective. And that's not just for biosimilars, that's also for biologics. We need to make sure that there is a very effective tracking system. Newborn screening. We have produced some of the most effective communications with states, with four states, educational programs for newborn screening for families who have a positive screen or diagnosis. Many of the states use our materials. We started out in 2010. It's now 2015, and this slide is incorrect because it's actually 31 states. And over 73% of births are being screened. Remarkable. There's the right map there. And you'll notice that down there, just a little bit east of Texas, and a little bit west of Mississippi, and a little bit south of Arkansas, there's that green state, the state that we're in right now, Louisiana. So we are very much interested in making sure that newborn screening comes to Louisiana. So I think that all of you need to tell Governor Jindal that Louisiana babies need SCID screening. And you can do that by going to the exhibit booth, the IDF booth at the exhibit hall. There will be a laptop there to send an action alert to the governor. But how many people in this room have downloaded the app on your phone? Good number. Go to your app on your phone on the second icon screen and just hit the Take Action button and send it right now. You can send it right now from your table. But we need to do that. 163 people have so far done it since Thursday. And we would like to have a lot more people doing that. We had a SCID rally here on Thursday morning with a number of SCID families. We had coverage in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. There's coverage in the Picayune. I don't know whether it actually came out today or will be tomorrow. Several newspapers. We had a tremendous turnout and, sometime next week, you can go to our website on the SCID newborn screening and actually be able to look at some of the television program. One station gave 2 minutes and 40 seconds of their news broadcast just dedicated to this issue and the interview and the stories that took place. And that's really, you all know what television newscasts look like. 2 minutes and 40 seconds is a pretty long time. We were very pleased to do that. So take out your cell phone and click on the IDF app, go to Take Action, and you can send your letter now saying, Governor Jindal, babies need to live. So I want to thank you for that kind of overall report for public policy. And I'd like to now move on. You know, when dealing with legislation and regulatory policy at the federal level, an advocacy organization like IDF really does need to have boots on the ground every day to find out what's happening and how it affects primary immune deficiency community either positively or negatively. And we're very fortunate to have Heart Health Strategies as our legislative consultants. Heart acts as our eyes and ears on Capitol Hill. And with us today is Sue Rampton, who is familiar to many of you, from Heart, who will tell us about some new legislative health initiatives regarding research and testing of rare diseases. Sue is a veteran of Capitol Hill, having worked in many staff capacities on the Hill for many years, and please welcome Sue Rampton.
Good morning. I'm actually here to tell you about new legislation that's important to the patient community, maybe something you haven't heard of yet, and that's the 21st Century Cures Act. So this legislation started over a year ago with one of the House committees really digging in, trying to have a number of hearings, talk to different groups, get input on what were the needs to bring treatments to patients sooner. It's a bipartisan effort, Republicans and Democrats, pretty equally split working together on this. The inspiration behind this bill is really patients. These two little girls got to know their member of Congress, as many of you did working on the Medicare IVIG Act, and their congressman happens to be the chairman of one of the health committees. And so he made this his legacy issue, to try to work on getting something done to make sure patients can get new treatments sooner. The bill really looks at six different areas, and with the time we have, I'm not going to go into the whole bill. It's over 300 pages. But what's important to know is it does invest in medical research, so it gives a boost to funding at the National Institutes of Health, NIH. It also works to integrate patient perspective, to make sure patient voices are heard. What do you think is important in research in your disease area? So the bill so far has been moving through the House. The committee actually unanimously passed it out, and at the time, one of the former chairmen sitting in the room said he couldn't remember any time that had happened, that it was a bipartisan bill with no one dissenting. So it's already scheduled for floor consideration, probably right after the 4th of July. And the bill really seeks to work in three different sections: the discovery of treatment, the development, and the delivery to the patient. So what does it mean for the patient community? And as I said, we don't have time to go into a lot of detail, but $10 billion more in NIH research, more of an effort and focus on rare and pediatric diseases, building in the natural history and data registries so they can learn more. And in the development, it really looks at, as I mentioned, bringing in the patient voice at the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, trying to look at how do you make clinical trials maybe a little bit less complicated. That's where biomarkers and surrogate endpoints can become useful, as far as do you have to recreate everything that's already been done. Precision medicine, a term if you haven't heard, you probably will. It's something that the president's been talking about a lot. It's got a lot of bipartisan support behind it. But what's important to know, it's personalized medicine. It's bringing in the unique patient perspective, making sure the treatment works for that individual patient. And then, of course, in the delivery, the clinical trials, getting things into practice, translational medicine, but also telehealth. As Christopher's slide showed, you need access to specialists in PI. Sometimes, because of where you live, that might not be easy. So efforts to improve in telemedicine could bring somebody closer to you, at least for consultation, so you're not having to drive every time. So where are we for the next steps? As I mentioned, the House is going to have this bill on the floor in about 2 weeks. They already have more than 230 co-sponsors. That's significant because you need 218 to pass. So they've got a good number there. The Senate is much slower in this particular bill. They just started the process this year where the House started over a year ago. But they've said in the fall they plan to have legislation and then will turn their focus onto this. So we will continue working with IDF to try to make sure that you're represented in that process and patient voices are heard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. We certainly will be monitoring not only the progress of 21st century cures, but also its implementation, should it be passed into law. Our next speaker is Mark Booten, the new CEO of the National Health Council. IDF is a member of the National Health Council, and in fact, Marcia is a new board member of the NHC Board of Directors. If you attended the advocacy breakfast at our last conference in Baltimore in 2013, you may remember Mark's great presentation about what impact the Affordable Care Act, better known as the ACA, would have on the insurance system. Because of popular demand, we asked Mark if he could share with you some of the wins and losses patient advocacy groups have had in knocking down the barriers to care over the past 2 years, and what can we see in the immediate future and medium future range too. Mark is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Health Council, the only organization that brings together all segments of the health community to provide a united voice for the more than 133 million people with chronic diseases and disabilities and their family caregivers. Think about that. 133 million out of 320 million in this country. Mark has been a leading voice for greater patient involvement at every stage of the continuum, starting with the development of new drugs, to regulatory oversight of healthcare delivery, to shared decision making at the point of care. Under his leadership, the NHC has convened a broad range of stakeholders to create and effectively implement pragmatic strategies and public policy that address the diverse issues, such as enhancing patient engagement, which we heard a lot from Dr. Selby yesterday morning, advancing the development of new treatments, and developing a better healthcare delivery system to meet the needs of people with chronic conditions. Let's give Mark a very warm IDF welcome.
So before I start, I want to thank Larry, Marcia, and their team for all the great work they've done on behalf of your population, but even more broadly on behalf of people with chronic disease and disabilities. So join me in giving them a round of applause. Thank you. So good morning, everyone. I know this group can do better. I spoke with you last year. Good morning, everyone. Much better, much better. I know you guys have had a long day yesterday. You got a long day today. I want to talk to you a little bit about how we knock down barriers. And I love the title. It's like a fight. Has anybody ever watched boxing? You go a number of rounds and you have a number of hits, but it takes a long time to get to the end of that fight. And we're still in the middle of this fight. And we've got to knock down a whole bunch of barriers. But there are two takeaway messages I want you to have. One is, we have been extremely successful at knocking down barriers. And we're going to continue to be successful. We're not where we need to be, but we can do this. We can have tremendous success. That's the first takeaway message. The second is that we need to change the arena we are fighting in. It's not good enough for us just to fight for each little advance. We've got to change the underlying system to make it truly focused on people with chronic disease and disabilities. That's coming next. That's our vision for the future. But let me tell you a little bit of what we've done and where we've come. You know, the National Health Council provides a united voice for people with chronic disease and disabilities. We do not do anything condition specific. Organizations like yours work on specific disease-related causes. But we work on ensuring that treatments get better and that the delivery of healthcare improves, that the system focuses in on us. We are an association, and you'll see IDF in the middle here. You are part of a collective of the nation's leading patient advocacy organizations, and you should be proud because we at the National Health Council have standards for you to participate. And those standards are the most strident in the nonprofit sector. They include finance, governance, research, staffing, conflict of interest, corporate relations policies. And we evaluate you to make sure that you meet those standards. You can count yourself among the best of the best in the world as a nonprofit patient advocacy organization. Be very proud of that. It's a testament to you and your staff. Now, Larry asked me to talk about the successes around the Affordable Care Act. And I'm going to highlight them, and I'm going to highlight them fairly quickly. But again, my first takeaway message is understand that how we collectively have tremendous impact. Now, the United States has looked at trying to create a system to provide meaningful access to everybody in the country 6 times over the course of the last 80 to 90 years. And it failed every time except with the Affordable Care Act, which incidentally survived its second Supreme Court challenge. Yes. And as the President said 2 days ago, it is here to stay. The politics of this, yeah. We've been saying for several years the politics of this would remain divisive, and it would take about 4 to 5 years for us to cycle away from that. We're now 2 years away from that cycle. This will remain a political issue in the primaries, but it will eventually go away. The only way this law changes is if the administration changes, the Senate changes with a greater majority, which is highly unlikely. We're here to stay. It's all about making improvements now. Huge opportunities. But the patient community, up until the Affordable Care Act, was never invited to participate in the discussions. Now, am I the only one who's incensed by that? Think about that. Every other stakeholder was invited to decide how we were going to provide access to care for people in this country. Everybody was invited, the providers, the insurance companies, specialists. We were not at the table until this last go-around. And that's important because the patient community went in, and we went in with a set of criteria we wanted to accomplish. We had 5 core principles, making sure everybody had the opportunity for meaningful coverage, to address costs responsibly, eliminate pre-existing condition exclusions, address lifetime caps, and address long-term care. With those principles, we had very specific priorities that we turned into legislative language, and all of them were included in the legislation. That's a huge success for the patient community. We have never had that kind of success on legislation like that before. So back to this, let's knock them out. We knocked it out. It was far from perfect, but we knocked it out. So can I get a collective pow? Oh, you can do better than that. I know this group. Pow! Yes, thank you. We moved into implementation. There were several years before this law was going to be enacted. So we started working on this in 2006. By 2010, we've got our successes in legislation. We now move into implementation, which is going to take a couple of years before anyone gets access. We looked at the implementation, and it was the patient community that came in and said, you know what? What you're doing in terms of building this out at the federal level and at the state level, it's not good enough. It was the patient community that went in and said one drug per class was insufficient. And for many conditions, you take multiple medications to treat your condition. One drug per class could be deadly. It was the patient community that went in and said, no, that is unacceptable. We will not allow that to happen. We were the groups that went in and said states had to monitor what they were doing to ensure it was not discriminating against high users. We still have a lot of work to do, but it was the patient community that said it had to be part of the rules. And we limited how insurance companies could structure their plans. There was provisions that would have allowed insurance companies to focus in on certain areas and exclude other areas, in particular areas of high cost. That's something the patient community said was unacceptable. We were able to change those rules before the first person received care under the Affordable Care Act. Can I get another collective pow? Thank you. 2014, so we've got our first rollout. People are starting to get access to care. We focused in on five issues. We wanted clear structures in place that did not discriminate based on cost. Now, we've had success there, but I'm here to tell you we need to do a lot more there. We demanded transparency. One of the greatest challenges is when you go into the marketplace, how do you compare one plan to another plan when the information is behind a firewall on somebody's website? We worked with people with chronic conditions to try and find the best plan for them, and we could not find the information with a team of PhD policy experts. When we called the insurance companies and asked them, do you cover X, Y, and Z? They often couldn't tell us whether they covered it or not. A complete lack of transparency. And if you could find the information, it was presented in a different format, plan to plan to plan, even from plans from the same insurance company. It was like trying to compare not apples and oranges, but apples and elephants. You could not figure out if your care was covered. I worked with people with cancer. These were people who had a diagnosis, they had a doctor, they knew what medicines they needed to take in order to live, and we could not figure out if their doctors were in network or if their medicines were covered, even when we called the insurance companies. Huge need to make the process uniform. And then we need to address continuity of care. How many of you take treatments for your disease? Quite a few. You know what works for you. There is nothing more infuriating when an insurance company tells you you need to stop taking the treatment that you have found works for you and to start taking something else. We have to have continuity of requirements. And lastly, we need enforcement. So moving into 2015, we got a huge number of important successes. This is incredibly exciting. Now, it's going to take place in 2016 and 2017, so these improvements are coming. When it comes to non-discrimination, we're going to see updates on the benchmarks that will set the bar higher on discrimination. We're going to see issues around network adequacy addressed. Huge opportunity to make sure that your doctor is covered and that you're not forced to go see somebody that you've never worked with, that you do not have a relationship with. there's going to be a focus on monitoring the formularies and to look at whether or not there are changes in the drug formularies or changes that are discriminating against high users of care. We're going to see new rules around utilization management techniques that will make it easier for people to get care that they want. We're going to see, for the first time, standards on the presentation of this data. And in fact, we pushed and we got HHS to say that it needed to be machine readable. Now, I'm not a very technical person, but what that means is that the data is going to be presented in a uniform way and it can be read online electronically. And so we can build systems that will go in and look at the plans and compare them apples to apples, not apples to elephants. And we're going to see new provisions around continuity of care. We still have a long ways to go, but we had success this year that nobody anticipated, and it's because of the advocacy of great organizations like this. Can I get another pow? Thank you. So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the work we did. We also did some quantitative and qualitative research focused only on people with chronic conditions and their family caregivers in the marketplace. And the results were not dissimilar to what you guys found in your survey. People want to understand what they're purchasing. They now have a mandate to go in the marketplace and buy a product. They want to understand what they're buying. And they want useful tools to help them understand and compare it. And they want it to be transparent, standardized, accurate information. These are just normal things. People are becoming consumers and they want to understand the care that is available to them. And they want to make an informed choice based on their needs. We developed a tool. It's a cost calculator and you can find it online called puttingpatientsfirst.net. It is the only tool of its kind that allows you to put information about yourself into the tool. It does not keep that data. And it will tell you which plan will give you the best coverage based on your needs at the lowest cost. And we did this by going to plans in every state and scrubbing through them, pulling the data and putting it online. This is something that the federal government was supposed to do and did not do. We fought the federal government, and a few months ago they announced they would do this. In 2016, the tool will not be as granular as ours, but it will be up, and they will be linking, hopefully, to our tool and sharing their data. We will be able to make this granular to the level of the zip code. And what it does is allows you to put in how many times you see a doctor, a specialist, hospitalization, surgeries, every medication right down to the dosing, and it will tell you which plan gives you the best coverage at the lowest cost because it is completely not intuitive. Most people have made their decision based on the lowest cost premium, and for high users of care, that is usually the most costly plan. We need good information so people can make good decisions. Several years ago, our president said it would be like Expedia.com. Put your information in, and you'll be able to pick your plan. We are now moving in that direction, and over the course of the next 2 years, we will have those tools in place. Can I get another pow? Thank you. It's not good enough just to work at the state. You guys have been, at the federal level, you guys have been doing great work at the state level. And we decided we wanted to help support your activities. So we developed a tool. It's a state-by-state report card. And we evaluated all 50 states to determine whether or not the policies they had in place were beneficial to patients, neutral or negative, whether they were high, medium, or low performers against that set criteria of are they discriminating, are they providing meaningful access, continuity of care, the things that are important to us. And we set this up very much like a consumer report. And in fact, the final version will be published next week, and you can open it up and look at every state and see how they score. And what this does at the state level, because everybody in the state legislature is running for attorney general, who's running for governor, who's running for senate, they all want to compete on who does this best. And when they see that they're not ranking very well in a certain area, it gives them the opportunity to say, I can fix this, I can do better. And you in the advocacy community can use this to push them and to support them to improve what's happening at the state level. Huge opportunities to raise all boats across the country. Now I want to switch gears a little bit. This is a long-term fight just on the Affordable Care Act. We've been at it since 2006, and we're not done yet. And as a person who has been a family caregiver to multiple people with chronic conditions, I think it's time for us to rise up and say, we're not going to take it anymore. We're fighting in your stadium. You need to come fight us where we are. You need to come fight us in the streets. I'm nothing but a street fighter. I grew up in northern Maine, in a very rural area where most people had no electricity or running water. The water that served my house was brought in from a lake and kept in this big earthen pot. That's where I came from. I left home when I was 13. I became a lawyer, a civil rights litigator. And what I found was I lived in a situation where I didn't understand the healthcare system. I actually was fortunate enough when I left home to get a scholarship to study abroad. I ended up with a British law degree. I was working in Europe. I planned on living there, where incidentally everybody has access to care. Challenges, but they have access. Everyone in my family, about the time I started to practice, was diagnosed with one or more chronic conditions. And they range from heart disease, cancer, neurologic, autoimmune, rare disease. And so I came home to be a caregiver, and I settled in Boston, which was close to where I lived. And you know what? I found the healthcare system to be one of the most frustrating, enormously complex, non-patient-focused system I've ever seen. I also learned that we were getting all kinds of treatments that in many cases don't work. Some cases they do, and we don't know. We have an opportunity to improve treatments and improve delivery design. It's time for us to take the fight on our own terms. This is a woman who is a patient advocate. She passed away a couple years. But I want to tell you what our definition of patient centricity is. Patient centricity is the intersection between clinical outcomes that we all want, patient experience, which we all know is not always that good, and the goals and aspirations that we all have. Everybody lives for a reason. Nobody lives to go in and get their blood work done. We live because we have goals and aspirations. We live to see our child walk down the aisle. We live to work another 5 years, to play golf. It may be you live because you want to take care of your pet dog. Everybody has goals and aspirations. So we need to develop a system that focuses not just on the clinical outcome, because for most of us with chronic conditions, we're going to use care that we receive until we die. Right now, we don't have cures. We hope for cures, but we don't have them. It's not like people who break a leg and go into the system, they get fixed, they go home, and everything's fine in their lives. We're all taking care of families, we have our spouses, we're working. There's a lot going on in our lives. Clinical outcome is only one of three things that's important. Our experience is critically important. You all know what care works for you given your life circumstances. I have a relative in northern Maine. She has lupus. She's a single mom working part-time. She has two children. One of the children has autism. Her mom lives with her with Alzheimer's. She is 8 hours away from a major medical center. Limited education, limited health literacy, low socioeconomic status. All of that has an impact on what she can do to take care of her family and her own health needs. We've got to meet people with chronic conditions where they live. We can't just simply say, here's the best clinical outcome, go do it and walk away. You know, the Institute of Medicine says that over 30% of care is unnecessary and wasted. Much of that care is given to patients. It may be clinically appropriate, but it's not aligned with what we're able and willing to do. We've got to align the clinical outcomes with patient experience. And you have to identify what are the goals. Why do people live? I think I shared this story last year, but I'm going to share it again. There's a woman I met in Baltimore. She's a single mom, has heart disease and diabetes. She's getting the best clinical care possible, and she's not doing anything she's supposed to do. When she walks into the doctor's office, they say, you're overweight, you're not taking your medicine, you're not exercising. And you know what? She knows that already. Nobody took the time to ask her why. Now, she's a single mom with two girls, one in high school, one in college. Her sole purpose in life is to make sure that her two daughters do not become single moms without an education like she was. She is going to do everything in her power to get those two girls through college. A lot of parents would do the same thing, right? Well, the medical treatment plan she was put on made her lightheaded and dizzy. And guess what? She drives a bus in Baltimore. She cannot provide for her family and be compliant and adherent. Nobody took the time to ask her that. Once the system understood that, it was easy to put her on an alternative treatment plan that didn't make her drowsy, lightheaded, or dizzy, that she could be compliant with. She's doing very well now. But nothing in our system focuses in on the whole person. Here's where we in the patient community are going to take this back. We are moving into an era where the cost drivers are going to be huge. The cost drivers in the Medicare, Medicaid, and the marketplace and the employers are going to escalate over the next 2 years. The next president, if there are a two-term president, will not be able to kick the Medicare can down the road again. It simply will not be possible. And if we go down our current trajectory, it means higher premiums, it means higher co-payments, higher co-insurance. All of these have negative impacts on people with chronic conditions. We need to build a system around what is truly important to the patient, not provide the care that they don't want, don't need, can't use, and eliminate the barriers to care that is appropriate for them. We call this the patient trifecta. If the care meets your trifecta, you should have access to it, and we should remove the barriers. If it does not address your trifecta, you should not have it. There's our opportunity to recoup the lost costs and to pay for care that people need. How we go about it is we start to change the quality measures. Imagine if there was a quality measure that said, you, the provider team, sit down with this person, her name is Rita, and say, you know, what is important to you? What are the important life goals you have? And in a facilitated exchange, be able to articulate what those goals are. What if we had a process measure that also said, understanding what those goals are, how did you wrap care around that person to help them achieve those goals? And then if we had reimbursement systems that paid the provider team to actually do that, that creates an entirely new delivery system. And this has been piloted. And when we pilot it, what you see is quality measures improve, clinical outcomes dramatically improve, and costs go down remarkably. This is the system that we need to have. And this is how we, as street fighters, are going to pull the system to us. We need to align this for all stakeholders. And there's an opportunity to make this a win-win-win for patients, providers, payers. Everybody can win in this system. So can I get one last collective pow? One more. Come on. Pow! Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Mark, very much. We appreciate those words, and there's a lot, we've got a lot of accomplishments, and we have a lot more to do going forward to make sure that we continue to knock down those barriers. Before we get to the question and answer period, I'd like to show you something. And this was something that was sent to us a few months ago that just kind of tickled my heart, and I wanted to show it to you all and then make a comment.